On behalf of TEC, the Executive Center's global community, I'd like to welcome everyone today to our next business webinar. We host programs every week, every month, across the Executive Center's global network. I'll do a brief introduction of TEC because we may have members, some not members joining us today, and then I will introduce Lehman Brown briefly and we'll get to our presentation. So the Executive Center, we provide premium private office space, co-working, meeting rooms, and event space across the Asia Pacific. We're headquartered in Hong Kong. We have more than 150 business centers across 32 cities, 14 countries and markets. And we are streaming today from all across the Asia Pacific. I'm based in Shanghai, China. So I'd like to welcome all of you today. We're very pleased to partner with our TEC tenant and corporate member, Lehman Brown. They are the leaders in international accounting, finance, business topics, and services, especially for small, medium-sized businesses that have operations across one or more markets in the Asia Pacific. So we're very pleased to talk about a topic that many of you probably are dealing with, the pandemic and how it's affecting your business and your cash flow and how to manage that risk. We know in China, things have gone more or less back to normal, back to the new normal, where for Singapore, for other markets, things are maybe in lockdown, there's more or less restrictions. So how are companies dealing with this? How can you manage your business's finances better? So we're very pleased to have with us today Russell Brown, who's the managing partner, the founder of Lehman Brown, and he's going to share more about this topic, go through some presentation slides, and then at the end, we'll have time for some questions. If you have questions at the end of his presentation or during his presentation, click the chat window button, type your question there during his presentation, and then I will read some of these questions. Russell will answer those. And at the end of this presentation, we will also connect you to Russell, to his team through email. So if you have any other questions, you can email him directly, get in touch with him. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Russell, pass the virtual microphone over to him, and he'll start his keynote presentation. Thanks, Russell.
Thank you very much, Stephen, and also to the Executive Center, who we have a lot of clients who are using their services and very happy to cooperate and partner with them. We're talking about cash flow calamity and risk during a pandemic, and many of you may have heard the wording, you know, cash is king, and a lot of companies, of course, are very focused on things like profits and loss. Well, profits and loss is great. It's a movement in a balance sheet between debits and credits, but really, when it comes to a pandemic, cash is the only thing that really matters, because if you haven't got any cash, you're out of business. And some people might say, well, we're okay in China, everything's fine. Well, take a scenario where you've got an overseas company that goes bankrupt and they owe a lot of money to the Chinese subsidiary, which they haven't paid. And the Chinese subsidiary doesn't have any money. And the Chinese subsidiary has to pay their suppliers, who have to pay their suppliers, who have to pay their suppliers. So there's a domino effect, or where a company halfway across the world can go bankrupt, but can actually force the whole chain down also to get into financial distress. So the first thing when the pandemic started, right in the early days of February, March, the first thing I said to all of our clients and even ourselves internally to our own finance, I said, cash flow management. I need weekly cash flows, forecasting 3 months ahead. And all I was focused in was not profit, it was just cash. Getting receivables in, delaying as best as you can payables, but being conscientious of their own financial position, because there's no point in pushing a supplier under, and basically bringing cash flow tighter in terms of the management. The other thing we've got to face in China is foreign exchange regulation. So you can't freely send money out when you need cash overseas, or bring money in when you need cash in China. So it does involve a lot more planning. So what I want to do today is just cover a bit about cash flow management, and more how you build a culture of cash management within an organization. So I'll start with just an introduction of some common issues, and then each of these I'm going to drill down individually. Quite often there's a lack of understanding of the banking environment or how loans or finance can be gained. Companies often have a lack of basic control procedures in cash management. It's often seen as, oh, it's the accountant's job. Lack of experience in local financial resources or accountants. An accountant is not very good at picking up the phone always to a client or customer and saying, hi, look, can you pay our bills, please? Lack of communication between different departments with regards to customers and clients. Inconsistent internal rules or regulations that you have to deal with. Inefficient use of funds, prioritization of funds. High borrowing costs. Lack of flexibility to handle sudden drops in revenue. For instance, how many companies do sensitivity analysis? A lot of companies do their budget and say, that's it. Great, we're going to follow our budget. But how many people sensitivity analysis that to say, well, what if there's a sudden drop? What if there's something suddenly happens? And the pandemic, whilst China is pretty much back to normal and growing pretty well, the rest of the world is still in the thick of it. There's still restrictions everywhere. And nobody, if you look at the newspapers, how many economists are doing forecasts at the moment? Very few, because they haven't actually got a clue where the world economy is going or a clue on how all this debt is going to be paid back. And so I think in terms of uncertainty, you know, that's still got a long way to go. And liquidity tied up in the balance sheet. Even if you're in a growing business and you've got, let's say you're 60 days out when clients are paying, but 30 days when you're paying your suppliers, if you're growing, you're going to run out of cash because you're receiving cash slower than you're paying. But this is what's called the valley of death. Now, actually, it's often used for startups, and venture capital firms often will look at this. I actually think it applies to any business in an uncontrolled situation, which a pandemic would be that. And the valley of the death really is, how deep is the valley? How much cash do you need to turn a business around or to survive through a difficult period? And how much planning can you do in advance of that valley to know where that valley is going to be so you can actually get out of that valley quickly? So as I say, it's often used for startups. This is actually a startup chart with a new product launch. But actually, I think you can apply it to any business in an uncontrolled situation of which a pandemic is. I mentioned a minute ago about cash flow forecasting. So how often do you forecast and for what periods? Some companies will do an annual forecast. In a pandemic, that's not enough. Even I would argue monthly wasn't enough going back, at least right to the beginning of the pandemic. As I mentioned earlier, I'd asked most of our clients to move to weekly forecasting. And I, even ourselves, I get a 12-week rolling forecast every week. It's a good discipline, as long as the information, of course, that goes into it has meaning. So looking at the frequency and the rolling and assessing that according to the situation at the time, testing it with sensitivity analysis, looking at what the worst case scenario might be, the best case, and testing the foundations of it, and factoring contingencies. What if this happened? Because there's, and just seeing where the balance of the cash flow might be. Because at the end of the day, in budgeting as well during a pandemic, you might have a worst case, a best case, a medium case, and then you've got your gut feel. What is the gut feel of the business? And that's the gut feel of the management as well. Setting up proper systems and internal controls, I think, are important. Making sure that there's proper controls on purchase orders, a clear policy on payments and who approves payments. And I'll talk about that in a minute in more detail. And having all payments forecasted. I've been through numerous times on this where I've said, if it's not in the forecast, it's not paid, because that stops your ad hoc requests. The accountant running at the last minute saying, can you just sign this check because we've got to pay? Well, so sorry, that should have been forecast. It should have been in the forecast and we should have planned for it. So it's about creating some discipline. So it's about building cash culture. And cash culture is with everybody. It's not just the accountants. It's not just the role of the accountants. In a pandemic, it's the role of everybody. Even myself as managing partner, I've been on the phone to clients. I've chased them and say, hey, look, can you pay our bills, please? Or you're in financial trouble. Okay, can we come up with a plan so you can pay us over a few months? Or we'll lock off the history. You pay that over a few months, but you pay the current receivables on time. And building KPIs within that, based on creditor days, debtor days, or other metrics, whether it be working capital days. There's another saying, revenue is only revenue when it gets paid. And there's loads of companies I know in China that are owed money by state-owned enterprises. They might be a year old. I know one law firm that has receivables that are 4 years old. They're still expecting to be paid. But it is a receivable. But it's not a receivable that's going to help you pay your bills right now. And always watching the costs and payment terms. also have another saying that you watch revenue at your peril. The first lesson I had when I became global CFO, this is my early days before Lehman Brown, I was global CFO of what was then Shamrock International, now Weber Shamrock Worldwide. The then chairman of the company when I became CFO, he said, Russell, you're watching revenue too much. He said, you need to watch the costs, watch revenue at your peril, because if you don't watch your costs and your revenue drops, then you're in trouble. And so always watch your costs. Why are people's forecasts inaccurate? Well, first of all, there's a poor system in how you collect the data. The cash flow model might have defects, poor quality of information coming in. The most important one is inaccurate assumptions. Salespeople are always over-optimistic in terms of their sales and always over-optimistic in terms of when they can get the money in. So you might take their over-optimistic collection forecast and add an extra 30 or 60 days onto that, looking at what unforeseen external factors there might be. So if one of your main customers is in a risk market overseas, you know, how much risk, and doing checks on that customer to see how financially viable they are. And as I mentioned, never assume it's always the role of the accountant. In a pandemic, it's the role of all management to actually manage the cash flow. So in terms of cash flow, it's about collation of the right information, analyzing it properly, and also doing sensitivity analysis, delivering in a format that can be understood by those that are less numerate, and then feedback. But it's a continuous cycle that should be going around on a regular basis. It's also about balance sheet management. If you can reduce your inventory, it releases cash. If you can reduce your AR and assets, it releases cash. So for instance, assets, if you've got fixed assets, can you finance them? If you can increase your accounts payable, it increases cash. So it's about looking at each part of the balance sheet and saying, how can this part of the balance sheet being pushed up or pushed down to release cash flow and improve the overall cash flow? So cash flow influences, there's many. I won't go through all of these one by one, but I'll just put them on the screen. There's those that are controllable, but there's also a lot that are uncontrollable. Sudden change in government policies, sudden change in banking regulations. So there are external things that you can't control. Countries suddenly putting in place foreign exchange rules that were unknown before. Whilst you can't control these, you can factor in, based on overall information collation, what might be a risk and what might not. So we're going to receivable management, common issues faced by companies. I'll talk about some best practices and some practical solutions. One of the first things is lack of transparency in credit history. How many companies actually do credit checks on companies in China or credit checks overseas? Obviously, globally, in the US in particular, you've got Dun & Bradstreet and Dun's numbers. But within China, there's also a lot of credit agencies that can do credit checks. And China's putting in place, albeit still in progress system, but a reasonably robust credit system that's coming in. If you've got a large amount of aged receivable with increased bad debt or complex distributors and suppliers, how can you rearrange that? And again, I come back to internal controls. Who looks at the AR list? How often? What's the role? When does it get escalated upwards? And also looking at the legal documentation. Do you have proper signed and chopped contract? Do you have documentation and proper documentation on each customer or client so that if you needed to write a legal letter or file to a court, you can. If you wanted to put a lien on a client, if you had to, you could. Common issues, also credit terms, often longer credit terms. And many companies, the finance person, the accountant, is a credit controller. Well, in my mind, most accountants, we're less temperamental than a lot of people, like say lawyers. We're quite easygoing. We like to sit in our background with the numbers. A credit controller is a different beast. They have to be more aggressive. They have to be able to pick up the phone. They have to be able to get through to a decision maker to try and force a receivable to be paid. But a lot of companies assume it's the role of the accountants, and the accountants aren't natural credit controllers. It's a different mentality and often a personality often. Also, do you have proper aging analysis and have you attached risk to each client in that aging analysis? And bad debt provisions, how much bad debt provision are you actually applying to your bad debts? So in crisis, I say a lot of balancing. There's a lot of balancing of priorities. There's a lot of balances of conflicting priorities within the organization. And it is about creating balance between risk and reward. Obviously, if you can't get paid by your customers, you're not going to be able to pay your suppliers. So it's about finding an effective balance, working with those customers that can pay quick or ones that you think you can push to pay quicker, those that you think are a higher risk, seeing how you can actually mitigate that risk a bit. And these are just a list of a few factors that link. At the same time with receivables, can you factor them? We've had a number of clients that have been factoring their receivables during the pandemic to release the cash from their balance sheets, working with China, banks in China on factoring. So there's a number of things in terms of receive excellence in receivable management, looking at your business process, your technology tools, staff skills. I mentioned about the personalities and have you got the right person chasing? Are they motivated to chase or who's pushing them? And actually creating that corporate culture around not just thinking about the customer, but thinking about how you get paid. It's about changing behavior of customers and coworkers, changing the behavior actually also of customers and suppliers, and trying to find solutions where possible. Also, it's about vetting. So do you vet your customers properly when you do a quotation? Do you factor in the pricing? Those that pay quicker might get a discount. Those that pay later might pay more. Do you put credit control terms and clear penalties in your contracts and through the order process? And how quickly are you invoicing? Are you invoicing in a timely way? Can you be invoicing in a more timely way? So in terms of contract administration, are the contracts clear? We know a lot of companies that have purchased a general contract, then they have purchase orders. And that's the main thing they base everything on. But is that purchase order solid enough in terms of terms and conditions? Contracts often don't include any terminology about Guanxi or Guanxi customers and related party customers. And have you done a check on related parties? I think reviewing all contracts, looking at the terms and looking at possibly adjusting the terms according to the situation with some customers as well. Another issue that we often find is complex pricing of contracts, which can cause confusion, and unclear warranty clauses is another example. So it's best to keep pricing as simple as possible and the terminology as simple as possible, so it's as easy as possible to enforce. Pricing the invoice accurately, pricing the profit on anything accurately, and also putting in place a dispute resolution as well that covers any dispute that you might have on the quality of the product, the price, and what should be delivered. In terms of credit control, a lot of companies may have credit terms, but they don't really enforce anything that happens afterwards in terms of added interest on top. Often the interest is forfeited, or there's not the right timing between, let's say, upfront, progress billing, final billing. And sometimes related parties have Guanxi credit terms, longer credit terms. So it's about looking at the overall risk, as I mentioned earlier. In terms of credit limit and in terms of the risk, I call it the 5C credit assessment: character, capacity, capital, collateral, and conditions, and possibly even ask for bank references from customers. But you want to check their current stability. When you might be, they might be a customer of you, but they might have another customer overseas that might go bust. And if that customer overseas goes bust, that's going to push them into a poor financial situation, which would affect their ability to pay you. I mentioned about the supply chain earlier, as how it can feed back. And it is important to understand your customers. I had one European customer who did credit checks on all their suppliers recently because they had 5 suppliers, which were major suppliers to the components that they needed. And they were the main customer of these suppliers. But these suppliers had other customers, and they were worried that if one of those other customers went bust, it might disrupt their supply chain. So they actually wanted to do a credit check going through to their supplier. And they wanted to look at their suppliers, other customers, to see how secure they were. In terms of invoicing, are you invoicing accurately? Are you invoicing on a timely basis? Are you tracking that through an ERP system? Are you using the FAPIAO within China as a way of getting paid? In other words, you don't get the FAPIAO until you pay me, or I'll give you a copy of the FAPIAO, but you're not getting the original until you pay me, and using that as a basis of enforcing or trying to enforce quicker payment. And are you making sure that the correct person receives the bill? And is that person the decision maker on when you get paid? Because they might be receiving and it might be the internal accountant, but they might be not paying. It might be somebody 2 layers up that's actually making the decision. So are you talking to the right person when you're collecting? In summary, good quality products and services are given. Obviously, high customer satisfaction. But then I think it's about accurate invoicing, adequate credit control, and looking at your overall whole process and strengthening that in a situation of a pandemic. Which brings me on to payables management, which is also as important because whilst you want to collect your receivables quicker, you also want to pay slower where you can, as slow as possible. But at the same time, I think you also have to be mindful of if you're a major customer of a supplier and you suddenly pay them too slowly, you don't want to push them out of business. So there's a bit of a balance, but you want to pay as slowly as you can whilst taking into account their own situation. You want to obtain credit terms or renegotiate credit terms where you can. Get discounts where you can for early settlement, though I balance that with the need to preserve cash. Sometimes you pay a little more to preserve the cash because if you're out of cash, you're out of business. The profit and loss is secondary in a pandemic situation. And work with your suppliers. Talk to them and do a risk assessment as well, as I mentioned, of their own situation. And they also look at their own flexibility. Also, with payables and payments, have proper segregation of duties. So look at who approves, because as I mentioned earlier about cash flow management and the fact that you may have, you know, that ad hoc, oh, we need to pay this now. You want to reduce that. You want to have everything planned as best as possible. The easiest way of doing that is to make sure that you actually tighten the approval process. So you relook at who has the chops, you look at the management role and who approves, and you also record the use of the chops. So you actually tighten that whole process of who can approve. So you look at the segregation of duties, and even more so as well with the pandemic, because it's not as if you can freely fly in management from overseas or have people from China, for that matter, easily go overseas. Normal travel has been disrupted. So therefore, often cross-border segregation of duties has become weakened because of that. But making sure you've got segregation of duties on the ground, where the chops are split, if you've got enough people internally, then that's fine. If you haven't, use an external provider like an accounting firm or legal firm that can add that segregation and also add that check and balance. And looking at who is the inputter, who's the approver, and looking at these payment limits. So re-looking at your levels of authority, looking at your level of delegation to the finance team, who will approve what, and looking at the limits. Are you going to have lower limits because you've got purchase order approval, but you've also got payment approval, and they're different or can be different. In terms of vendor selection, if you haven't been out to tender for a while, tender. Go out if you can, if you're in a position to go out to tender. Do reference checks and not just look at pricing, but also look at credit terms and also look at the terms that you can get and look at the strength of that supplier. How secure are they versus the other supplier who may be less secure? But having a proper approval process and having the purchase orders, and also once you've made a purchase order, have that flow into your cash flow, back to your class cash flow planning. So having proper checks, no payment is made unless it's properly authorized, no payment is made unless it's forecast, and also factoring the FAPI hours as well to make sure you obtain FAPI hours from vendors for all payment. Now, business risk, during a pandemic, it's not just in China risk, there's global risk. But I put risks into these key areas, six areas. And it's about when you're forecasting your receivables, you're looking at your payables, you look at your internal management, you're looking through your internal structure, factoring in what risks might apply. So market risk, obviously you've got competition, the new products, innovations. We've seen a lot of tech companies, for instance, replacing non-tech, but looking at the market risk, human risks, going out to tender, making sure that the risk of fraud is reduced. Also mindful if you've got unions, because China's growing. Maybe there's going to be price pressure on salaries against, for instance, but the rest of the world isn't growing. And the rest of the world, I don't think, has even got to that cliff of economic damage yet. At the moment, they're just building debt. The economic woes are probably still to come. And that will, by nature, have a knock-on effect on China. China's economic risk, China government policies, they can be positive and negative. China's bringing in incentives in certain areas for certain businesses, whether it be Hainan, the Bay Area, Shanghai, the tech zone in Beijing. So there actually are also positives in terms of change in government policies, but there's also economic risk in terms of policies being taken away. Example, if you're getting a VAT rebate, and that might suddenly get taken away because they've gone and changed the catalogue of what the rebates might be. Have you got the right management in place to run a business through changing times? A manager during good times is not necessarily good at managing a business during bad times. They're different skill sets. During difficult times, different decisions have to be made. And have you got the right management in place to actually make those decisions? Looking at your internal controls, business risks, suppliers, logistic chains, I've talked about a bit already. Legal risk, do your checking. You can do a lot of checking now on your suppliers. I mentioned credit reports. You can check on their ownership structures. if you're worried about related parties and price inflation because of that, or unknown related parties actually is the main risk. Sometimes if you haven't been able to get out to those new suppliers, have you done the checks on those? But assessing all of these risks relative to the business when you're doing your cash flow management and you're doing your forecasting. So in summary, as I mentioned earlier, cash is king. No business, no cash, no business. It's about looking at, I think, reassessing the business, and particularly from China, because China is doing so well in terms of how it's coming out through us, come out through the pandemic. It's not unaffected by the world impact. If suddenly the world did get into more economic trouble, which it could well do, and customers stopped buying things. If you're making things, then who are you making that good for? So it's about looking at good customers, paying on time, big orders, etc., defining good suppliers, looking at debt, liquidity planning. I mentioned factoring and receivables, but also if you've got assets, you can go and loan out to a bank, for instance, for security, getting people through your staff and your management thinking about cash flow, making it part of your culture, having meetings on cash management, and thinking about forecasting and how accurate are your forecasts? How much tied are they to the business? How much is the information that's flowing into that cash flow accurate information? And having each department be involved in the whole process, not just the accountants, and actually having management understand it. If the management aren't good at seeing lots of spreadsheets and numbers, create a summary of it with the key metrics, but at least making sure they fully understand it. And I think that's critical. At the same time, it's also understanding, getting head office overseas, if you're an overseas business, to understand you can't just bring money into China when you need it, and you can't just send money out of China when you need it. We've also had customers that were doing really well in China during the pandemic, but they were struggling overseas and they needed cash out of China. But you can't just easily transfer money out. So yes, we went and did dividends and they declared dividends. They also weren't cross-charging for support that they were providing at head office. So we put in cross-charging service agreements. Well, they also weren't charging for use of IP. So we put in place IP agreements. But that all takes time to actually get registered with the authorities and with the banks to actually get that cash flow moving. But you can't just send it over to do cash pooling. That all has to be factored in and planned. Other to-do lists for cash flow management: review the cost base and the nature of costs. We've said to some clients, well, you're a top-down, you should look at zero-cost budgeting, bottom-up. Reviewing your projections, the basis, the accuracy, the economic impact. I've said about sensitivity analysis. Reviewing the headcount, the productivity of the headcount, the efficiency, are they the right skill sets? Capital spending plans, rolling cash flow mentioned, and also P&L. Reviewing your overall policies and also reviewing the government policies around your business at the time. Can you get a government grant? Are there any incentives available? So it's looking at your overall business, I think, again. Internal controls. Whilst most companies have some kind of controls in place, if you can't freely be flying management around to do reviews, then have external parties do reviews. But either way, review your internal controls and review your risks. Put in place checks and balances. Make sure those controls are known, communicated, and that management are behind them and understand them. Look at who has access to management to address any concerns. And also putting in place, if you haven't got it, a fraud no culture. This is part of the fact that you can't fly people freely in and out. Make sure you've got a very clear fraud no culture, testing those controls to make sure that they're strong, and making sure that people know that if there's fraud carried out, there's consequences. And I would say a 10% commission paid to an employee is a 10% increase in the purchase price. So remember, it's about cutting costs, increasing sales, but also looking at your overall cash flow. Also, at the time, we've also seen negotiations where people have said, we found actually that credit terms are much longer because there's a hidden arrangement behind, or they're much shorter because there's a hidden arrangement behind. So with that, I'm open to questions and anything that people may have to ask.
Great. I'd like to start with a broad question. Since the pandemic broke out last year, what do you think is the biggest change that companies have had to make on the operational side? Are there some fundamental shifts in how businesses are operating now as the pandemic? It seems like it will go on for a long time. in one form or the other in almost every market. I know for the office industry, of course, for TEC, we see more flexible work arrangements. We see companies moving more towards hub and spoke model, where they don't have just one big central office. They have a smaller headquarter office, but then several satellite locations, or like TEC, you could use any of our business lounges in the network. So you offer your employees more flexibility. So from the HR side, I think there's been, you know, huge fundamental changes. You know, they'll be more or less lasting in different markets. But for the finance side, what do you think are the biggest sort of permanent or long-term changes in business operations?
So I think actually the word you said there, flexibility. So definitely, I think it's made companies reassess their risks. I mean, so whilst companies will have looked at economic risk before, the economic risk has gone from maybe you just look at one country now to you have to look at the whole region or the world. And so we've seen companies look at risk, which we have seen, say, some manufacturing clients of ours who have decided to outsource the manufacturing. So to local manufacturers to de-risk their own position. They're still bringing product in from China, but they're moving to more of a distributor sales structure. So they're more nimble, more flexible, and less risk. Or if they are manufacturing still, they're looking to reduce their balance sheet assets by financing where they can, or reducing, as I mentioned earlier, the inventory on the balance sheet or the assets that are being utilized to actually create the generate cash flow and profit. So de-risking, I think, is the key change. And that has also led to companies looking at their overall cost base. And I think initially, maybe not, but now I think companies are starting to also look at their people and say, have we got the right people for our structure in the future? I mean, the future will be a more nimble structure, I think. And actually, I think with your service centers, I think you're quite well primed for that. We've also got new customers coming into China, new clients, and they're looking for flexibility. They've got products that they make overseas. They want to sell into China. They might assemble in China or finish it in China, but they might not do it themselves. They'll have a team that manages that process, but they'll share the risk with other companies within China.
Yeah, I think that's right. So another question is from Benjamin. What are the supply chain finance options within China mainland market, supply chain finance options?
Right. So we have had customers factoring receivables, but we've also had customers work with banks on their suppliers as well. So this is where I think it comes down to using these credit agencies that do exist now in China. And so there's actually, we've gone from very little information and transparency in China many years, sort of 10, 15 years ago, to actually quite a reasonable amount of information. When there is a central, there are credit agencies and there is credit information now in a central database. Not all companies are on it, but a growing number are, because they realize that to be able to get financing, you need that to go to the bank, but also you can check that position with your suppliers as well along the logistical chain. So I think the availability of finance is becoming much easier because the availability of financial and credit information is becoming more available.
Yeah. We have many questions, so I'll try to read through them a bit quicker. Someone else asked, how does cash or bank-wise work from China to another country? So I think if you're sort of onto the question, transferring in and out.
So you can only bring cash into China in the form of investment, registered capital, investment loan for payment of products, services, or IP. Or interest or dividends linked with that. So you can only send money out in the form of dividends, interest bearing, repayment of loan or interest, products or services. So you need to plan about money coming across the border. Money coming in is registered with the State Administration of Foreign Exchange by the banks. Money going out is registered with SAFE by the banks. There is a myth that it's difficult to get money in and out. It's not. It just involves a bit of planning and paperwork and bureaucracy.
Yeah. Another question, cash flow isn't easy to deal with in terms of moving cash in and out of China. How can you start to make the risk assessment for cash flow when you have risks you can't easily control? For example, changes in tax refund policies with no transition time. Example, in the steel sector in May, it was canceled and it was just advised one day in advance that there was a shutdown in this policy. Yeah, so sometimes from the regulatory side, maybe it's difficult to deal with changes in the policy that can affect cash flow.
And that's correct. And yeah, I remember back in, I think it was 2007 or eight, over, I think on a Sunday night, they changed something like nearly 2,000 VAT refund rates to be effective the following day. So it's not uncommon for this to happen if you look over the history. The only thing you can do is say, with this sensitivity analysis, you know, look at what the worst case scenario would be. What if I didn't get a refund? What if that was taken away? Or what if there was a tariff put on, assuming a reasonable assessment of what a worst case might be? What would that do to my business? How would I survive that? Or can I survive that? So it's a matter of playing around with numbers. And actually, when I look at the accountants as well, I would say to companies, there's two types of accountants. There's financial accountants, and I always say they're good at preparing statutory books. But then you've got management accountants, because forecasting is an art form. It's not science. It's about playing with numbers and playing around with different scenarios and seeing what ifs. And that's sometimes a different mindset. And it's about making sure, have you got that person in your organization that can actually play with numbers, can look at these different scenarios? So whilst you can't forecast what might happen, you can say, okay, I've got a 14% VAT refund. If that was taken away from me tomorrow, what would happen? How would I look at my supply chain and also my all the way through to eventual customer? And can I survive that?
Yeah, I think with a lot of the cross-border trade tariffs and economic disputes ongoing, everybody needs to pay attention to what's going on, sort of have a forecast, like you said, for the worst case scenario versus what you expect maybe will happen. And certainly, I think also just being aware of the market trends, participating in business forums like TEC hosts through our community, it's more and more important because there's so many tariffs and surcharges being added on cross-border. And most TEC member companies are multinationals with business across different countries, several different countries. So I think that's something that we have to do. Another question is about sales optimism, generally speaking. What percent of businesses, Russell, would you say are optimistic going forward this year, next year, for their sales outlook in the China market, Russell?
That's a very good question. I always say to as well, you can never not have enough information in this time. So if you're not active with the Chambers of Commerce or not a member, I always say they're a good source of information. So I'm on the board of directors of the Australian Chamber of Commerce and the British Chamber of Commerce, but we're very active with the American Chamber of Commerce, the European Union Chamber of Commerce. The movement in the reports that the chambers have been doing in terms of economic outlook have upticked. I think most people are quite positive on China in terms of China as a market. In terms of globally, I think it depends on industries. Companies that have managed to really hunker down, reorganize, and become very efficient, and also have been managed to shore up their cash flow, I think very well geared for when the global economy turns around. Companies that haven't made those decisions, I think, are the ones that we're going to see in more economic trouble. So I'm very bullish on China, and I would say Asia Pacific. The US will always reinvent itself. What if you had to say, what am I personally concerned about? I'd probably say Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they tend to be a little bit slower in the process.
Yeah, I think, from our experience working with the members, by quarter three, quarter four of last year, there was already a huge recovery in China. I think TEC by the end of last year was already basically back to where we were pre-pandemic. So China's been a very fast recovery, but not for everybody. So I do think there's a good amount of optimism going forward. But of course, with the pandemic, you never know exactly what might happen, because we know when there's a new outbreak, there will be controls put in place to keep everybody healthy. So that's something that nobody can predict, right? Why don't we do one more question, one or two more questions? Russell, what are some cash flow considerations companies maybe have not thought of during the pandemic, or things maybe that people overlook, things that are not well known that maybe can be done, but are not common knowledge, let's say, or things that maybe companies are not doing during the pandemic yet that you would recommend?
Okay, so I'd say, well, first point is maybe back to the foreign exchange question earlier. So if it's to relook at your registered capital investment loan, there are thin capitalization rules in terms of the amount of investment loan you can have relative to your registered capital. But if you haven't got an investment loan in place, an investment loan is where you're lending, or you have the ability to lend from your head office into China. So it gives you flexibility. So if you registered it, you have the flexibility to bring that money in when you want it, and when you don't need it, to send it back. So, and it takes, you know, let's say a month or 2 months to get it registered, but it's worth registering and having that in place. So adjusting your articles of association, factoring in an investment loan if you haven't actually got that in place, because it gives you some cash flow flexibility. I would also say, secondly, looking at your payables and receivables, if they're within intercompany, you can balance that between China and offshore. If they're customers, can you go to the banks and factor or borrow against? Because the banks have become much more flexible in terms of the whole ability to factor. Good. And lastly, I would say, look at what incentives there are in your area or in other areas within China, in your industry with government, because there are government incentives that are specific to certain areas and certain industries to try and encourage business. And I would say, try and look at those.
Yeah, I've talked to members sometimes and learned a lot about very industry specific or restricted incentives that they have that probably most people don't know all the different incentives they could take advantage of if they apply, if they've done the research. So I think that's also something to consider, especially when the macroeconomic climate is a bit uncertain going forward. Yeah. Great. We have one final question, Russell, I think, and then we will wrap up. So generally speaking, to send dividends out of China, how long would that take?
Depends on where you are in the country to how fast they're processing, but typically about a month. I mean, it can be 2 months, it can be 2 weeks, but if you say a month, it's a rough guide. As long as you've had an audit report done and you've paid your corporate income tax and done your filings up to date, it's just a matter of having a tax approval and assessment of the withholding tax and then paying the withholding tax and then going to the bank. So it's actually reasonably straightforward. You can do interim audit, interim dividends as well, which is actually not widely known. So let's say you had a great flying half for half year. You can do an interim audit, signed off, and then still do an interim dividend. But it's not well known and it's not often done, but at least something you can do.
Good. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Russell, for sharing so many concrete insights and advice.
My pleasure.
Here at TEC, we organize about 600 programs each year, covering different industries, functional roles inside the companies. But I think, of course, for finance issues, it's a very concrete, specific topic of discussion. So I think we have a lot of good takeaways from this webinar. And I want to thank everybody joining us today. I think we will call an end to this event. Thank you, everyone, again, for joining. Thank you, Russell, from Lehman Brown. Look forward to seeing you again. Thank you, Russell.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye. Thank you.